From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. Russia signed a treaty annexing Crimea, the first time a European nation has seized territory from another since the end of World War II. Crimea, which had been part of Ukraine, is our common legacy, Russian President Vladimir Putin said. Quote, it can only be Russian today, unquote. In a separate speech, Putin complained about 20 years of mistreatment of Russia by European countries and the United States. Meanwhile, President Obama expanded sanctions against Russian leaders, including several close to Putin, and Russia responded with sanctions against American officials. And a Russian official hinted Russia may interfere with sanctions to persuade Iran to limit its nuclear program. In the United States, polls indicated Republicans may rebound strongly in the midterm election in November. I was struck, Barbara, I'll start with you, by a piece in the Washington Post by Ann Applebaum, who's a columnist for the Post, but is also married to the Polish foreign minister, which puts her in a unique position. And what she says in her piece is, for the last couple of decades, whether it's the Obama administration or the Bush administration or the Clinton administration, we have looked at, and so many people writing about Russia, we've looked at Russia as a flawed Western country, that if it just had political reform and economic reform, it would act, it would respond to that and become a country just like others in Europe. And what she says is, we've just had this wrong. That Russia is completely different. She says, for the first time, many are beginning to understand that the narrative is wrong. Russia's not a flawed Western power. Russia is an anti-Western power with a different, darker vision of global politics. What about that? Have we just looked at Russia the wrong way?
Well, Russia is Russia. I mean, you know, whether it was under the czars or under communism or under Yeltsin or under Putin, there's certain basic facts about the country that I think have a lot to do with its behavior in the world. And Putin is just the latest iteration of that, although there are special characteristics that Putin has, frankly. I mean, he has a really dark view of history, and he has a major chip on his shoulder over the way in which the Soviet Union was dissolved. But while all this has been going on, I've read an absolutely fascinating book by Gregory Pfeiffer, who used to be the National Public Radio correspondent in Moscow. His mother's Russian. His father went to Russia in the, you know, for the famous kitchen debates back in the 1950s and so on. Has a really unique perspective on the country. And there are just some startling statistics. You know, you look at why do countries do things like this? Yeah, the Crimea used to be part of Russia, you know, and all the rest. But under Putin, the social, cultural demographics in the country have gotten even worse than they were under Yeltsin. I mean, it is just astonishing. Things like corruption. It used to be you had to pay $23,000 a year in bribes to get a business started. It's up to $135,000 a year under Putin. Every year, between $50 and $70 billion has left the country in capital flight abroad. The amount of alcohol people drink, the deaths from alcoholism. One in five Russian men who die each year die directly because of alcohol. The average Russian male consumes 10 gallons of pure alcohol a year. You know, AIDS.
That's a lot.
AIDS, tuberculosis, you name it. This is a country that is in trouble in so many ways internally. And what do you do when things are going wrong inside? This is something not just Russians have done, but dictators throughout history. You get involved in a spat with the international community. Mm-hmm. You do something to spur nationalism and, you know, to distract the public's attention. And that's what Putin has done.
Tom, I want to pursue this with you as well, at least with one question, and read you something else that Ann Applebaum wrote in the Washington Post. And that is, she says, Putin invaded Crimea because he needs a war. This is what Barbara was suggesting. In a time of slower growth and with a more restive middle class, he may need some more wars, too. This time, it's really not about us. Right. Us meaning the U.S. and Western Europe. These are things that Putin is doing as a Russian on his own. I remember, and he's not looking for an off-ramp. He doesn't think he's made a mistake.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. He doesn't think he's made a mistake. He's doing this mainly for domestic political consumption, but it has the added advantage in Putin's mind of sticking his thumb yet again in the U.S. eye. I mean, Barbara is right about a chip on the shoulder. I think the Russian psyche has just been nursing a colossal chip on the shoulder for 50 years, long before the Soviet Union broke up. I can remember 25 years ago, there's a visiting group of Soviet journalists, and I was at Newsweek at the time, and they were invited to come have lunch with us. We put together a very nice lunch, and basically it was just a one-way dialogue with the leader of this delegation. It was a diatribe upon diatribe, and he kept saying, "We don't get any respect. We demand respect. We demand respect." He kept saying it, and he kept saying it, I have to say, as he was spitting grape seeds onto the table from the grapes he was eating. But anyway, I think that's part of it. But it's that's the extra added benefit here of doing something that I think Putin thinks he needs to do at home, and also irritating the U.S. and irritating the West.
You know, Barbara, I wasn't sure what Angela Merkel said, or at least it was leaked, about her conversations with Putin, where she thought he was paranoid or a bit crazed even. And then there was his speech a few days ago that seemed, as you said, he has a chip on his shoulder, and he thinks of Russia's been betrayed by Western promises, and we plundered. And it was one of the most amazing speeches a leader in the world has given in my lifetime, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the comparisons with Hitler and all
the rest.
I don't You know, but I mean, you know, Hitler played on the fact that Germany had been humiliated and unfairly treated, and Putin plays on the fact that Russia has been unfairly treated since the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, that he sees that the rest of the world has tried to move the borders, you know, closer to Russia of NATO. Certainly, there was a lot of controversy, and I remember writing about this in the 1990s under Clinton, about whether it was wise to absorb so many formerly Soviet republics into NATO. And what would be the impact of that on the Russian psyche? And now we know what the impact of that has been the Russian psyche.
Even though the expansion of NATO was stopped before Ukraine.
Yeah, but, you know, when the Ukraine signed an economic association agreement with the European Union, that was repudiated and now has been restored, Putin saw that as a stalking horse for NATO. First the EU association agreement, then comes NATO. So I think some of this is legitimate. Some of it has to do with mishandling of the situation by the European Union in particular, making an economic association with Ukraine an either-or situation. We've talked about this in the past, that because of Ukraine's position, geographic position, as a buffer between Russia and Europe, a buffer that Russia still appears to need, you can't make it either or. It has to be a neutral place that has economic relations that are equivalent with all of its neighbors. So, yes, an agreement with the EU, but not exclusive. Also has to have some sort of agreements with Russia as well. And the EU played it badly, and, you know, it all went south from there. But Putin is, you know, he's a particular type of Russian. Not everyone is like this, but his background in the KGB, serving in East Germany, the experience of his family in Leningrad, what was then Leningrad during World War II, during the terrible siege by the Germans. His older brother died of starvation during the siege. You know, he has his background, and one American leader after another, I think, has misjudged the depth of his hostility, insecurity, and anger.
Tom, what about that? You know, it makes it hard to know what would be a policy that would contain Russia under Putin and deter him from doing things like his annexation of Crimea.
Well, it's hard to see what the formula would be. The U.S. has agreed to bring Russia into the G7, which is now the G8, although it may revert to G7 as a result of this. The United States supported Russia's bid to get into the World Trade Organization. And so it appears that by making nice with the Russians has not gotten the U.S. or the West much. I don't think there's anything. I think the success, the relative ease of the Crimean takeover has probably got Putin thinking of other sorts of things. Now, the Russian defense minister assured Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel the other day that the thousands of Russian troops massed on the Ukrainian border doing exercises were just doing exercises and that they had no intention of moving in. This is the same Russian defense minister who said about 3 weeks ago that the troops near the border of Crimea had no intention of going in either. So I'd be a little nervous if I were Chuck Hagel or the Eastern Ukrainians.
Yeah, Chuck Hagel being the U.S. defense minister. What about these sanctions? The European Union has had some sanctions on denying a few Russian officials access to visas and so on, and the U.S. has had them, and there's been a response by Russia. To me, these don't lead anywhere, although we know that President Obama, which the White House has announced, or at least let be known, much stronger sanctions that would really limit, and these may be unilateral sanctions by the U.S., would limit Russia's access to the financial community, at least so far as the U.S. is concerned. What about all this, Barbara?
Well, first, I just want to read you one quote from Putin's speech that I neglected to read before that I think shows his mentality and the way he thinks he's a victim. He said, "If you press a spring too hard, it will recoil." So that's what he thinks he's doing. On the sanctions, actually, the latest tranche are getting kind of serious. And, yep. And, you know, this is something that the U.S. government has perfected since 9/11, when it started going after so-called financiers of terrorism. And then it really sort of came into its own with the Iran sanctions that effectively cut Iran out of the international financial network. And now it's starting with Russia. It's not just individuals who are close to Putin, and some of these are very close, but also a bank, Bank Rossiya, which is the 17th largest Russian bank. It's also been involved in a lot of shady deals involving taking over bits and pieces of oil companies and so on. The largest shareholder is a guy named Yuri Kovalchuk, who's the personal banker for Putin and other Russian leaders. This bank now will not be able to do any kind of business involving dollars, which means its goose is cooked. You have to have an ability to process transactions in dollars, or you can't operate on an international level. And some of these others, people like the Rotenberg brothers, who made a pile out of the Sochi Olympics, they're very close to Putin. People like the head of the Russian railways, a guy named Sergei Ivanov, who's ex-KGB, very close to Putin. Putin's chief of staff, Gennady Timchenko. This is getting serious. Mm-hmm. Already we're seeing things like Standard & Poor's downgrading their outlook for Russian growth. The Russian economy, as was pointed out earlier by Ann Applebaum, is anemic, was barely going to make 1% growth this year. Now maybe it will, you know, recede and won't even grow at all, and that's going to have an impact on the entire country.
Tom, what about the sanctions? Are they it's sort of tit for tat, and I'm not sure they lead anywhere or have any impact.
They are getting closer.
At least the American sanctions are getting closer to Putin.
Well, I thought the first set of sanctions were pinpricks, just cosmetic wrist slapping. But I agree with Barbara that the second tranche a little tougher. But I'm still wondering why the U.S. Did not put on the sanctions list the head of the Russian the gas conglomerate. That, I think, would make Moscow really sit up and take notice. So I know President Obama likes gradualism and incrementalism, but it seems to me every time Obama has done or said something, Putin has basically just waved it off. I mean, the thing that surprises me about all of this is President Obama has been on the phone with Putin several times for more than 4 hours. I'm not sure I would be an advisor saying to him, "Mr. President, this is great. You know, you get on the phone with Putin and you tell the truth to him and Putin just ignores it." I don't think that's helpful for Obama's public image, and forgetting politics and public image for a moment, it doesn't seem to have had any impact on Putin and Russia's behavior. No. So I'm a little mystified by that.
Mm-hmm. My question is, are the Europeans, particularly the Germans, so intertwined economically, Tom, with Russia, both investment in Russia in billions and billions and billions of dollars and relying on Russia for natural gas and so on, that the strong sanctions that the U.S. has done and talking about even stronger ones, are these something that the Europeans just, I mean, they aren't going to go there?
Well, I don't think they're going to go there to the degree that the U.S. would like them to go there. Chancellor Merkel of Germany has gotten religion because of these conversations that you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. But I think the British were going to be the last to fall into line. I mean, British journalists have taken to calling London Moscow on the Thames,
yeah,
because you have so many Russian oligarchs buying these zillion-dollar houses. Years ago, Arabs, especially the Saudis, mm-hmm, who were buying up London real estate. I know Newsweek's elegant bureau very near the U.S. Embassy was bought up for some ungodly amount. It was like $25 million for a four-story townhouse. Well, now the Russians are the ones who are not only snapping up real estate like that, but building these mega mansions all over the place, and London banks are the, I don't mean this in the illegal sense, but London banks are the launderers, mm-hmm, for billions in rubles of the Russian, what the U.S. has begun calling the Russian cronies. Mm-hmm. So I think the British government, mm-hmm, is very nervous about this, and I think Prime Minister Cameron is going to have to do a delicate dance, mm-hmm, to keep from looking like a complete wimp on this subject.
Barbara, I'm going to turn to you on that question in just a moment. But first, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of the National Journal and Barbara Slavin of AlMonitor.com. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Now, Barbara, what about the Europeans? They're, mm-hmm, entwined economically in a way that the United States is not with Russia.
Yeah, I mean, the major issue is that they get about 30% of their energy from Russia. But here again, you know, the trend lines are not good for Russia and Vladimir Putin. United States is self-sufficient in energy now. There's talk of the U.S. actually beginning to export liquefied natural gas to Europe. The Europeans are looking into shale and other forms of alternative energy as well. And over time, Russia's lock on energy supplies to Europe is going to diminish. So this is a short-term, you know, boost for Vladimir Putin, but I think long-term it's disastrous for Russia. And his successors, if he ever has any, will have to deal with that.
What's the long-term here? Are we talking about, you know, 6 months, 5 years? What do you think?
We're definitely talking about into the next administration in the United States.
Okay. Well, that's two and a half years.
This will darken clouds, yeah, for Barack Obama for the remainder, mm-hmm, of his term. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Barbara, let me start with you. What about this very veiled hint, mm-hmm, from a Russian official about making things more difficult, mm-hmm, in the nuclear talks with the Iranians?
Now, this is a big concern. Up until now, the so-called P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, have been unified on getting the Iranians to agree to certain terms for an interim nuclear deal that was reached last year and in the talks that have proceeded. If you begin to see disunity, that's when the Iranians can start to try to blow big holes through the international community and take advantage of particularly an unraveling of sanctions. The Russians have been hinting even before this Crimea mess that they might start doing some more deals with the Iranians that would violate the sanctions that have been imposed. And now we're seeing more hints, you know, that in return for a swap of Iranian oil, they would provide new nuclear power plants, mm-hmm, various other goods. So they could definitely relieve the pressure on the Iranians.
And you think the Russians are really serious about this?
You know, if the United States, I mean, the sanctions that have been imposed so far are annoying for Russia, but they're not really, as Tom pointed out, getting at the crown jewels, you know, Gazprom and Rosneft, these two big companies. If this crisis were to escalate and if sanctions were placed on Russian energy companies, then, yeah, I'm worried that they would begin to bust sanctions in a major way. And, you know, all these efforts to get the Iranians to agree to a more long-term arrangement might fall apart.
Tom?
I suspect, Fred, this is part of the reason why the U.S. government has been perhaps a little more cautious than some would wish, because the simple truth is the Obama administration needs the Russians on a lot of other things, like Iran, notably. I might probably throw in North Korea, and of course they're a major player in Syria, as we all know. So I think President Obama is trying to thread a needle here, but the Russians have a great capacity for gumming up the works in a lot of different places if they get pushed too far. And I think within the White House and the State Department, they're spending a lot of time late at night figuring out how far can we go without risking a really disproportionate response on things that have nothing to do with this crisis.
Mm-hmm. You know, I noted that the Swedish foreign minister said that the European Union probably made a mistake, and he implied the U.S. did too, in not responding initially when Putin claimed that Russia had a right to rescue or do something to help Russian-speaking people or Russians in other countries. You know, this right would, if you accepted it, would certainly give Putin a lot of leeway to go into eastern Ukraine and other countries as well. Barbara, what about that?
Yeah, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. Yeah, Coney Island.
I saw the comment by Carl Bildt. I mean, again, this is a function of the very abrupt and messy way in which the old Soviet Union fell apart, because there were Russians all over the Soviet Union. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Soviet Union was gone, and you had millions of Russians still in the Baltic states. You had them all through Central Asia and, you know, kind of marooned in these places and concerned about what their rights would be. There was a big event, I remember, in Estonia. This caused the first sort of cyber war incident, where the Estonian government decided to pull down a statue of a Russian soldier from World War II. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Russian hacktivists went nuts and completely dismantled or at least stopped service by all these Estonian government websites for hours and hours, because they were so furious about, you know, this insult to Russia and the history of Russia in World War II. There are a lot of potential touchstones for this kind of behavior. But, you know, that said, Crimea is unique. Predominantly Russian, was Russian until 1954, when Nikita Khrushchev, who himself was Ukrainian, decided to give it to Ukraine, which was meaningless because Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. So, you know, let us hope that everybody will take a deep breath and pause with just this one thing. However, the Ukrainian government will also have to be very careful going forward, I think, not to further provoke the Russians into taking more steps in eastern Ukraine. And here we have to watch. There's talk about U.S. military aid to Ukraine, and the provisional prime minister has signed that agreement with the European Union. This is all going to be very delicate.
Very delicate. Tom, are there things that the U.S. can do, or the Europeans can do, or NATO can do, or the European Union can do to challenge this claim of a right to rescue other Russians in other countries by Putin?
Well, we can roll our eyes diplomatically and say it's really preposterous, but I don't think that's going to defer Putin. We have to hope that Putin may be a lunatic, but he's not insane, and that he understands for lots of different reasons that there's probably a limit to the mischief he can make in terms of possible military action and military occupation.
Barbara, you'll be happy to know that while I had suggested in the introduction we talk about the midterm elections in November and so on, I'm going to skip that, because I want to ask you about something you said, and that is that we have 2.5 more years of the Obama administration, and then we'll have a new administration, Democratic or Republic, mm-hmm. who knows. But you made it sound as if American and European policy toward Russia is going to be really the fundamental axis of foreign policy for years to come.
Well, it certainly looks as though it's going to cast a wide shadow over everything we do for the next couple of years, because, you know, Russia, as was mentioned, Iran, Syria, you know, Obama has a major priority in terms of nuclear nonproliferation, reducing the stocks of fissile materials in the world. He's going to a big conference to talk about that. You know, what role will Russia play in that? Russia is one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council with veto power. Obama is a big believer in the UN and getting UN sanctioned for various activities. Russia will make sure that that's going to be very difficult. This is extremely bad news for Syria, and the news there was already grim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the former U.S. ambassador to Syria says that he can't see anything happening with Bashar al-Assad now for some time, that Assad has consolidated control over about a quarter of the country, the crucial quarter of the country. So, you know, Russia has no incentive, certainly had very little incentive before, has no incentive now to try to push Assad out. And it's going to be hard for Obama. I think we've got to hope for his sake that Obamacare really works, mm-hmm. because that may wind up being his legacy issue mm-hmm. after all.
Tom, we have just a little bit of time left, but it is amazing how things that months ago or a year ago we wouldn't have thought would become central to American and European foreign policy and economies and so on, and now it's there.
Yeah, and I think President Obama is left basically for the rest of his term with damage control, both diplomatically, geopolitically, and internally here in this country. I think he's going to be treading water for the rest of the way. He doesn't have the support to do what he'd like to do. If he, mm-hmm. if he loses the Senate in November, he'll be reduced to governing by veto, denying mm-hmm. Republicans what they want to do. I think it's gridlock and damage control the rest of the way.
Well, it certainly sounds like a lot of the president's time and Angela Merkel's and European leaders, a lot of their time is going to be concentrating on dealing with Russia for a good bit to come. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor of National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.